Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
The eagle-eyed amongst you will notice that things are a little bit different today because we're at Race Retro and we're surrounded by some of the world's greatest motorsports bits of history, some of the cars, and also some of the people. Joining me today, we have Matt Oxley and Freddie Hello. Spencer. Thank you both so
Hello.
Much
Great
for,
to be here.
For joining me. Now, Freddie, we did a podcast last year with you talking about your history in the sport, and we covered loads of topics. But today, what we're going to try and focus on is the 2017 season. It's MotoGP, and by the looks of things, it's going to be incredibly exciting. I don't think anyone for the last 10 years has started a conversation like this without starting with the Italian Valentino Rossi. He's entering his 22nd season now. Can you comprehend why he still does it?
Well, first off, 22 years in Grand Prix racing at the very top is a feat that you wouldn't normally see. And it's obviously speaks volumes about Valentino's inspiration that he has within himself, his will to want to keep doing it, to push himself. I think also the fact that he's had these challenges in the last 6-7 years, you know, with Lorenzo when he came along in 08-09, and then that transition to Ducati that didn't go very well, and then coming back and wanting to prove that he could still win a race first, which he did in 13, and then to win the championship, which he almost did in 2015. I think it's also the fact that he's been re-energized by Marc Marquez coming along in 13, and then also his dirt tracking, you know, his ranch, and riding with all the kids that he does in his academy. And so he's utilized very specific things that I think has kept his motivation going. And at the end of the day, there's no one loves being Valentino better than Valentino, and he's great at it. And he's inspired his contribution to the sport. He knows his place in that, and what he's contributed to the growth of Grand Prix racing outside of the motorcycle community only. And it's interesting. I know we'll talk a little bit about specific things as in the broadcast that I want to address that I think. You know, we're at a critical point for him, though, at his age and the changes with the front tire a little bit this year and with the arrival of Vinales. And it's going to be interesting.
I think the kind of crazy thing about Valentino is it's everybody says, oh, well, this will be his last year or he can't keep upping the pace and so on. But kind of what I've realized is you can only judge people generally by what other people have achieved. And so you tend to do that with Valentino, but the thing is that you actually can't do that because already he's way ahead of what anybody's achieved. And so you can't actually say, well, he's going to, this will be it, because, you know, everybody else, when they get to 38, they've had enough. You have to judge him as completely unique, because obviously, yeah, to want to do that after 22 years is just, you know, he does it because he loves it, but, you know, it's almost impossible for anyone to imagine what it would be like to still be racing at the highest level after 22 years in cars, let alone bikes, you know.
And you know, talking about 22 years, the amount of change in terms of technology, riding style. I mean, Freddie, what he's had to change things so many times, and that's kind of one of his, you know, one of his best assets, I guess, is that he adapts so well.
Yeah, it's one of the things I respect most about what Valentino's done, because having raced 500s and won races and championships on that bike, the two-stroke, with no electronics or anything, and the two-stroke is a very unique in its characteristics, engine characteristics, so the way you ride the bike. And then to make the transition to the MotoGP bike, and then this latest evolution in his riding style of getting off the bike further, and that he basically, you know, Mark, first Casey did that really, and then Mark Marquez kind of refined it. And so, you know, that I respect a lot, that he was able to do it. And later in his career, in his age, you know, he made that change in his riding style in his late 30s, mid-30s, you know, and it's not easy any time to do that. And so to be able to do that and to be competitive. And the other thing, too, is ability is one thing, but the racecraft is the real key for him, that his ability to run a consistently quick pace is his strongest asset. And in my opinion, he's gotten better at it later in life, even though he hadn't won a championship these last years, is he makes less mistakes now, I feel, than ever, which is I respect that.
I think one of the things with Valentino that, you know, outside immediately just riding the bike, is that all through his career, he's been surrounded by the same people who are the kids that he grew up with.
Yeah.
And he has carried them with him everywhere. And obviously he's immensely wealthy now, so he can do everything in a really easy way. He fly, use private jets to get places. But one thing that stops a lot of people from racing is they just, like Casey Stoner, they're just fed up with being away from home the whole time. And that eventually, after 10, 15 seasons, gets to you, and you want to retire and slow down a bit. The thing about Valentino is he kind of takes home with him.
Yeah.
You know, he's actually not away when he travels, because he's surrounded by the same kids that he was spending time with when he was 5, 10 years old.
Yeah.
So, and they're all on an adventure. You know, basically, let's go and have some fun.
Yes.
And so he makes the whole traveling thing a very pleasurable, well, as pleasurable as it can be, and it's like he's not away from home. And I think that's a big reason.
Yes, I agree.
The way that he's still able to keep racing.
Well, if you look at it, for sure, that's why I said that there's no one understands being Valentino better than Valentino. And so he understands his place in doing that. And that has a lot to do with it, too. It's fascinating. Back when I raced, I raced, you know, off and on, you know, 10 seasons. And I would always travel back to Louisiana every 2 weeks. And I would, you know, basically come to a Grand Prix, show up, go to a race, get back to the plane and go back. And you're right. As I got older and the way what I'm doing now and what I'm riding now and the traveling, you know, I've basically been traveling for years doing it. I could have never imagined doing this. But for me, and this is the point I want to make, is that Valentino understands. It's why he didn't go do cars. He understands racing. And he actually, that's when he's at his most at peace, is at a Grand Prix, you know, preparing, working with the crew, like you said, and doing that. And there's something very, very special about that and his contribution to that. And I think that's a lot of it, too, is it's not a job. It's more than that, you know.
Speaking to Eddie Lawson, who obviously was a big rival of yours,
absolutely.
He only raced the last two seasons of his Grand Prix career. He wanted to stop. And his management said, well, you know, what do you need to continue? What can we do to help you? And he's basically, like you, he came back. He went back to California after every race, and he got to the point. He said, literally, I just couldn't get out of the chair to get in the car to drive to Los Angeles Airport. He just couldn't do it. He was like, I cannot stand it. So the management said, how about if we get a helicopter to pick you up? He was like, okay, let's give that a go. Okay. So that was the thing that kept him going for another 2 years. So literally a helicopter would arrive in his garden, pick him up and fly him to the kind of VIP entrance at LA Airport, get on the plane, off you go. So that took away a huge chunk of pain in the, excuse me, arse kind of work side of racing, which a lot of people don't understand, that the racing's almost the easy bit. It's the traveling, relentless traveling, the relentless being away from home, out of your comfort zone, hotels, you know, after a few years, it drives you crazy.
Is that why you still go to all the races, that you've got a chopper picking you up and then off in your private jet?
Exactly, yeah.
Glint in your eye. We mentioned him earlier in the conversation, but Maverick Vinales, for those that kind of don't know him, because he hasn't come out of nowhere. Everyone knows he's extremely quick, and I think is going to put a lot of pressure on Rossi. So we'll talk about that in a second. But new teammate, Matt, just a little summary. Who is Maverick Vinales? Where does he come from?
Maverick, he comes from, you know, the burgeoning Spanish scene. 2 years younger than Marc Marquez, but actually beat Marc Marquez. They used to race mini bikes against each other. And he actually beat Marquez a couple of times when they were probably eight. Maverick was 8 or 9, and Mark was 10 or 11. So, and he fought his way up into 125s. As soon as he arrived, he was one of those guys you thought, wow, I think he won his fourth Grand Prix race with a kind of amazing, brave move at the last corner, you know, just kind of slightly crazy. But that's kind of what, you know, you see that will to win straight away. Bang, this guy, he's determined to do whatever it takes. Won the Moto3 title on the last corner of the last race. You know, with a fantastic move, just completely took the other guy by surprise. Won the world championship by about 3 inches, basically. Just cut under him in the corner and just beat him to the line. Won his second or third Moto2 race, which was again one of those moments where you go, wow. Yeah, he just jumped on a completely new bike, double the horsepower and everything, straight away, bang. So that was the moment. I think you can ride, you can win in 125 in Moto3, and that doesn't actually mean you're going to make it all the way. But as soon as you get into the intermediate class, and you win, you go, right, this guy, he knows what he's doing. He's got it.
And he's obviously coming in, Rossi's teammate. Rossi has had quite a history with teammates. What's going to happen here? You know, are they going to get on? I mean, they're getting on at the moment, but they haven't started racing yet.
Well, a lot of it depends on how much Valentino struggles, if he does struggle. You know, if you look at the preseason testing, what's been impressive about Maverick is the fact of his adaptability from to the Yamaha, which, you know, should be, you would think, it's a little easier bike than maybe the Suzuki, you know, in its versatility. That's what everybody pretty much says. If you look at how quick he's been on different racetracks, you know, Sebang, well, he was at Valencia, then Sebang, and now at Phillip Island. It's a very good indication of his ability to adapt quickly to a circuit, which is another strong asset that he has, and great riders do, is their ability to adapt quickly to a new environment, new situation. So, you know, it's very fascinating. If we talk about maybe the difference right now, because they were one of the things that Valentino had said and everybody agreed, they talked about is the Yamaha's, the M1's performance late in the race using up the rear tire with the Michelins. Last year they felt they struggled with that. So I know that's what they're working on. From what I understand, the new front tire is on the Michelin is a softer carcass, which requires usually a little better brake control on the entrance, not as aggressive. One of Valentino's strong suit has always been under braking, and I think that's hurting him a little bit, as we're seeing with the new construction front Michelin. Vinales doesn't seem to be having any trouble with that at all. He adapts to that pretty well. So we'll kind of have to see, and that's going to be an indication of how well they get along. You know, we saw with Jorge and Valentino when they first got together, what, in 08, 09, and Valentino struggle a bit. There was some friction between the riders. You know, he's competitive. You know, he wants to be the guy, and he normally is.
I think Jorge turning up at Yamaha kind of rather shocked Valentino.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, eventually he walked out because he said, you know, it's either him or me. And Yamaha going, well, you're quite old now.
Yeah.
This was 10 years ago.
Exactly.
Or nearly. You're quite old. So the future is with Jorge.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're very different. Valentino and Jorge, incredibly different
yes.
characters. Whereas I think Maverick and Valentino are much more similar as human beings, much more laid back. You know, you would never call Jorge laid back. He's very sort of quite in your face, whereas Valentino and Maverick, both quite humble, kind of ordinary people, really, you know.
Yeah.
But what might help Valentino is, A, he's used to being beaten now. He wasn't used to being beaten, really.
Yes, and that's Jorge what's different up. This time. I agree.
So he's kind of, it's not going to destroy him. But also, Vinales' riding technique is much more similar to Valentino's than Jorge's was. So that could actually help
Absolutely.
Valentino
sure.
because
sure.
Jorge had the bike very different to the way Valentino did. So, you know, if Valentino was lacking something, he couldn't actually use a lot of Jorge's setup and so on to help him. But if Maverick and Valentino have a very similar setup, a very similar style, Valentino may be able to use, because obviously they can see each other's data, they can see each other's setup. So that actually could be a positive for Valentino this year.
You know, Matt, you said something that's very interesting, and this actually surprised me. When I read about the biggest problem that Jorge was having on the new Ducati wasn't just the mid-corner steering issue, which has been around forever. It's been around. Jerry Burgess, I was talking with Jerry years ago about the problem with Valentino on the Ducati, and that was a big issue. That's something we all want is, you know, it's really important mid-corner for the bike to steer off throttle or at least hold its line when you initially pick the throttle up. And the Ducati struggles with that. Everybody knows that. But Jorge was talking about on corner entry that he was having to adjust to using the brakes so much deeper in the corner. And it surprised me because trail braking is usually everything for us at the top level because not only to utilize it to help you steer the bike sooner in the application lean angle, but also to keep some weight on the front, you know, for front grip. And Valentino, it sounded like Jorge, the Yamaha, was really good on mid-corner steering. Well, I know Valentino is really late on the brakes, so in that aspect alone, Jorge and Valentino wouldn't have anywhere near probably the front setup, front chassis or front suspension, you know, setup. And where Vinales, I agree, is more similar to Valentino in his riding style.
Before we started recording, we were talking about Marquez and Vinales and how that they're probably the sort of two main protagonists for the title. I'll just jump in, actually. If you can hear things in the background, that's because Ari Vatanen's on stage quite near us.
Yeah.
So bear with us. But so Marquez, Vinales, is that really those two? Is that what we're looking at for this season?
Well, I think This is what I notice or what I believe after watching him in Phillip Island. And there was one part where they actually went out together. When Mark came into the championship in 13, and he, you know, broke my record with the race win in Austin and then went on winning the championship. One of the things that I liked about him coming into it was he was going to raise the level, I think, of everyone else. He has that ability. And Jorge even talked about that, and Valentino talked about that. Is you know, Mark forced them to raise the bar a little bit higher. And now it'll be interesting to see, but I think the battle with Vinales is going to make Mark go into another gear, and I think Vinales to go with him. That could be a real difficult thing for Valentino and Jorge. Not because they can't, but just that, you know, it's like Kenny and I in 83. One of the things about 83, I feel, that made that championship unique was if you look at the lap times from year to year between 82 and 83 at each of the Grand Prix, Kenny and I went quite a bit faster than the year before, and mainly just us, you know. And so we pushed each other. It's one thing reason I respect Kenny so much. Now, Kenny was just 31. He wasn't 39 like Valentino. But the fact that Kenny, because I know how much quicker I was between 82 and 83, not just in the bike, but in my performance, what I adjusted, my mid-corner direction change was much quicker. And I was 21 years old and still dramatically improving. And Kenny stayed right with me and pushed me even more. And I think you're going to see that with the two young guys, with Valentino, I mean, with Mark and Maverick. What do you think?
I think, unless something strange happens, I think it will be Maverick versus Mark.
I'm not saying it'll only be them, yeah.
You could well be right that they're going to push each other and drag themselves ahead of everyone else. So obviously last year we had a record nine different winners.
Yes.
This year could be very different.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Well,
I mean,
not,
you know, there's so many other variables with Jorge going to Ducati. And I mean, that's been the thing with the Ducati for the last few years. You know, it will win one or two races.
Yeah.
Well, last year it won two races. There were always two or three tracks where it would work well. And I think that'll be the same this year. I could be completely wrong. Jorge could win in Qatar because he goes very well there and the Ducati goes really well there. But just because he wins in Qatar doesn't mean he's going to challenge for the title. I think, you know, look at him at Phillip Island, like you say, in the mid-corner turning problem. They've got long corners there. If you can't get the thing turned mid-corner, you are completely lost.
Yes.
Because, you know, so...
Well, the only thing you can do is you roll off throttle or you can't accelerate. I mean, that if the bike won't hold its line or keep steering, that's your only choice, and you lose your momentum. What I was going to say was the other thing about last year, because you brought up about the nine different winners, and it'd be great to see that this year, and I'm not, you know, throwing the other guys or saying they can't compete with Mark and Maverick at all, Cal and the other guys. But usually what you see after a season like that, with the manufacturers specifically, is you see them raise the level of the works bikes too a little bit. You know, there's a little bit of that in there where, because I can promise you Mark and Danny were saying, listen, you know, we need it. They don't want that many other people having a chance at winning. It's just the way it is. And the same thing with Valentino and Maverick, or if it had been Jorge, is Valentino saying, listen, you know, we need some separation here. And last year was the first year of the ECU, the new box. They have a whole year now of refinement with what they're set up in the engine characteristics and stuff. So
I think just talking about the factory guys saying hey to the factory people, to the engineers saying hey, I want you to focus on us a little bit more because we got problem enough as it is without having
I
think HRC seem to have quite a. Cal seems to be really in there with HRC.
Absolutely.
Cal Crutchlow.
Yes.
And they seem to value his input.
Yes.
Honda have made... They haven't had the right engine last year. They didn't have the right engine the year before. And I think both of that was largely, well, partly due to Mark and Danny maybe making the wrong call during testing. And I think they've thought, well, actually, we could do with another guy here.
Yes.
Giving us another... And Cal being very direct in his opinions and so on. So I kind of thought there's no way that he's going to do what he did last year, Crutchlow. But I think he actually could be quite strong. And you look at his race pace from Phillip Island was actually very, very strong. And you think, wow, he could be up there. You know, whether he wins another race, I don't know. But I think he will be up the sharp end, you know, which will be good to see.
Just thinking about Marquez finding another gear that's worth a sort of season ticket on its own, isn't it? I mean, imagining him going to another level. Well, I think that's a perfect moment. For me to talk about this, there's a lifestyle thing that you can do on Mercedes-Benz website. And if you go to mercedes-benz.co.uk/lifestyle, it's extremely clever. You can put in your car registration number if you own a Mercedes, and then it can tell you all the things that you can buy for it, whether it's baby seats, or cup holders or iPad holders. It's actually extremely clever. For the number of times that I've bought something that is for an entirely different model of car from mine, highly recommended. So do head along to Mercedes-Benz.co.uk. You touched on Honda and Cal and things, but One of the big things from Honda this year is its new engine, and it's actually done a sort of an extra private test that you were saying, you know, is almost unheard of. Just talk us through what is this engine? Why change?
Well, it's a big bang engine. It's something that it's not a new concept. All the other factories use it, apart from KTM. It started in 500s when Freddie was racing 500s. Comes from dirt track actually in the States, when they were trying to basically, you kind of bunch the power pulses together to kind of, it just gets the tire to hook up better and makes the bike easier to manage, especially over race distance. And I think Honda have, you know, they've had the Screamer engine for some years. Screamer engines are much more efficient fuel-wise, and a few years ago we had 20 litres, so getting an engine to the end of the race was a real problem. Now you've got 24 litres, so I think you don't need this. This one of the big advantages of the Screamer is gone.
Yes.
So they're going to big bang, and it makes the engine more user-friendly. But they've obviously you've got to change your riding style a bit, and it makes the engine braking becomes very different. And obviously Freddie rode Screamer engines in 500s and he rode big bang, so there's probably no one better to ask than Freddie.
And that's exactly right, man. And you said all the technical side of it. From the riding side of it, I'll never forget the very first different fine engine we had was actually in 1985. I was in Surfer's Paradise, and they had this engine there, and Irv said they want to test it, but you got to stay another day. And I said, okay. And I'd been there for 9 days testing. But I stayed. And I did a few laps. It vibrated. It was real flat. Didn't have any over rev, which I love engines with over rev. And so I said, well, it's okay, you know. But it's nothing. It wasn't spectacular at all. That summer, we're at Le Mans. And I'm struggling on the V4 at Le Mans. And I couldn't get the power to the ground. And Irv said, you remember that engine that we tested? Well, we have it, because I tested it, and they kind of continued moving forward with it. He said, we could put that in. It probably would help on the bottom. We put it in. I went out, got pole, won the Grand Prix. And it was basically sealed it to where I could go to Silverstone. But it wasn't anywhere near like the big bang that we got years later. So if we move forward to 92, I tested the Honda in South Africa, and it was amazing, the difference. And this is where it's different right away. And this is where Mark is going to benefit. Is if I can get the power to the ground, if the bike holds its line, I'd pick up the throttle back there. You know, I literally like to pick the throttle up sooner and sooner and sooner. And it makes all the difference, corner exit, your exit speed, your consistency on being able to pick the bike up, and all the things that that save tire, consistent race pace, late in the race, things like that. And so that's what the Big Bang engine does. It allows, as Matt said, it to get the power to the ground, but it also, it's that initial pickup of throttle is a little, that transition into the power band is a little bit smoother. On the two-stroke, it was tremendous that day I tested in South Africa. In fact, when I asked Irv, I said, what do you think? He said, you can pick up the throttle even sooner than you realize, and it was true. And so with this engine, I think we're seeing that in testing with Mark, is his race pace is improved because the bike is so much easier to get it off the corner, and for someone of his ability, that is like giving him an advantage. And and I think it's certainly, as we talk about the M1, you know, that's what's been, you know, that firing order, the crossplane. And it's just it's interesting. It's, you know, it's not something new. The Harley Davidson dirt trackers, you know, that's what made them so good on slick grooves and getting their power to the ground is the way they fire, you know.
Have you ridden sort of recent MotoGP bikes?
I've ridden the 990, the 800.
So just try and kind of, for the listeners and the viewers, what are these things actually like to ride? Because, I mean, they are so, so quick.
Yes.
You know, I think because the MotoGP riders are so good, they don't make it look easy, but, you know, they make it look a lot easier than it actually is.
Yeah,
just tell people a little bit about the current bikes.
The modern MotoGP bikes, because of the amount of horsepower they have, the electronics are necessary. And what the electronics do is, as they've evolved over the years, because I rode the very first MotoGP bike in 01, McDoon and I, and we were at Motegi for the Grand Prix, and at that time the electronics was more reactive instead of proactive. For example, I coming on the front straightaway, the rear tire broke traction, the electronics kicked in and kind of corrected itself before I could get off the throttle. And I thought, okay, you know, that was a really good thing. Nowadays, and you see it even on the modern sport bikes, I rode the Fireblade, the new Honda Fireblade a few weeks ago in Portugal. They are more proactive and they're in the background. And what they do is they, you know, if you get a little too abrupt with the throttle, the electronics can help you out. And but still, they're like any race bike. To ride it on the very edge is extremely difficult. They accelerate so hard, the modern bikes. So much stopping power. And the rigidity of the bikes, because of that much horsepower, is one of the things that I think they're always working on to try to get that feel back. But, you know, the bikes have evolved. The packages, the chassis, suspension, tire performance, all that works better together, you know, than, let's say, a bike 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
Now, obviously, one of the big movements, 2017 or end of last year, Lorenzo to Ducati. Ducati has had a difficult time over recent years, but it does seem to be improving. Matt, what can we expect from Lorenzo at the Italian team?
Well, as we were saying, I think it's going to be quite up and down. Certainly, in his, you know, to Ducati, Lorenzo is the kind of final piece of the jigsaw. Since Gigi Deligny came in at the end of 2013, at which point Ducati had been in a horrible doldrums for ever since Casey left, because Casey had basically been digging them out of a hole for years, you know, and it was basically him that was doing it. And as soon as he left, that was it. They didn't win another race for 6 years. So to them, Lorenzo is, you know, they've been chipping away. The bike's been getting better and better and better. And he, okay, we buy the top rider, or a top rider, and away we go. But I don't think it's going to be quite that simple. I think the bike's still going to be up and down. It's going to have tracks that it works at, and it's going to have tracks that it doesn't work at. And the strong point of the Japanese bikes, the Honda, the Yamaha, and the Suzuki, all of them really, is that they're very, the Honda less so probably, it's less neutral, but they basically work well wherever you go. You dial them in a way. Ducati's never been like that, you know, and it's more of a kind of, speak to riders who've come off Japanese bikes onto the Ducati, they say it's a lot more raw, you know, a lot more like a kind of V8 hot rod, kind of against a kind of nice, you know, saloon car. You know?
Why is that? Surely Ducati want to get rid of that characteristic?
I think, well, you know, you could argue, you know, it's a race bike. It doesn't need to be comfortable. But then, you know, maybe being comfortable is a positive thing. You know, it's a hard one. You know, it's very difficult for a group of engineers to just become another group of engineers. You know, they have a way of working, and that way of working gets passed from engineer to engineer in that company. So it's very difficult just to completely switch the way you design a motorbike overnight. And Ducati have always had their own way of doing things. And, you know, that's been one of their own biggest advantages. Many times, sometimes it can be a disadvantage. So, but yeah, you're right that they have been, I would say, making their bike, for want of a better phrase, more Japanese in recent years, and trying to make it more of a corner speed machine, which obviously should suit Lorenzo. But you know, it's going to take a while for him to adapt to it, and for them to adapt the bike for him. I think he could win 2-3 races, but I think some other races they'll be tearing their hair out, and it'll be interesting to see how Jorge reacts, because he's not. Although he, you know, does a lot of meditating and stuff like this, you know, the reason he meditates is because he runs quite hot. You know, yeah. He's a little bit wild in the head, and he needs to meditate and bring himself down. And he's been with the Yamaha for 8-9 years, and that bike is a joy to ride at all times. He's now in a situation where, you know, how his patience is going to work with things not going his way, that will be very interesting to see how he deals with that.
And the responsibility. You know, there's a responsibility that is there for him now, because everyone knows why Ducati hired him. I mean, they've stated it. Now they want to win the championship. And so there's more than just the fact of adapting to a new bike. but he's been given that responsibility and being paid that amount of money to accomplish that. You were talking about characteristics. It's fascinating how there's certain characteristics a bike has. For example, I brought up being in Portugal a few weeks ago, and I only bring it up for this reason, is that I haven't ridden a Fireblade in quite a few years, really my 08 bike. Three laps, it was like going home. And when I ride my NSR 500, there's a certain feel to it that is very similar to what I, with the Fireblade. I get on an M1, and it feels like a Yamaha. There's a certain aspect of the engineering, the technique, a culture that's within a company that you see. And for me, it's one of the things I actually like about riding, and everybody out there who rides a motorcycle or has their favorite bike, you know, you don't have to be a Grand Prix racer to understand that. It's one of the great things about riding a motorcycle, in my opinion, is there's characteristics. And so that is interesting. And you see that. I know, for example, when I was doing the bike development of the original NSR project, is that one thing I would drill into them and just constantly talk about is forgiveness, adaptability as a rider, is that I don't want to have to ride a bike to a certain level to get it to work, which is, I think, where they're at a little bit with the Ducati, is the amount of work it takes to change direction. You hear Paul Espargaro and them and Bradley talk about with the KTM, is you got to ride a certain level. What I want, and this is where I think the Yamaha is at that level, is it's a bike that'll go with you. I want a bike that I can go to that level, which is at that edge, and maybe a little beyond if I have to, and I kind of know what it's going to do. It'll work with me, you know?
I think that's another reason why Honda have gone to the Big Bang, is because when they had the Screamer, they also had their own electronics, and they could massage the engine character and so on to make it do what they wanted. Now they've got the control ECU.
Exactly.
They can't do that.
That's
right. So they've had to, you know, they cannot tame the Screamer
that's
anymore.
Right.
So they've had to go to a Big Bang. KTM come in now with a Screamer, and straight away the riders are going, oh my god,
you
got to ride this bike really wild, it's a real beast. So straight away they're saying exactly the same things about the KTM that people were saying about the Honda. And so it will be very interesting to see whether KTM, you know, they could overnight, they could
of
say
course.
Tomorrow, right, we're going to go to a Big Bang. Wouldn't be a big problem for them, a small company, they can make that change very quickly. But it will be interesting to see whether they can make it work, and if they can't, how quick they go. Who knows, they might already have a Big Bang engine on that, they might be going, oh, we need to already explore other avenues.
Why did they go down the Screamer engine route then?
Well, engineering wise, numbers wise, it's a much better solution. You know, on the dyno, it'll give better numbers, it's much better balanced, it uses less fuel, it's better on the overrun. So all these things, tick, 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 you know, I think that's the
more
way to
reliable.
Go.
It's easier to make more reliable and produce the power. Yeah.
But
absolutely.
That's the weird thing about motorbikes, you know, that until it might look really good on a dyno, but then you give it to the rider and he's going, oh my God. You know, they're saying, but and that's been a thing in motorbike racing forever, hasn't it?
Has,
but here you go, Freddie, this thing's got 10 more horsepower.
Exactly.
And you're going, oh, I cannot use that 10.
Yeah. I've come in a couple of times with the engineers and they go, but it's better. And I go, if it's better, maybe you can ride it, but not me, you know? Right.
That's brilliant. I'm going to come back to Ducati in a second, but because we're talking about KTM, how serious an effort is this, this squad? Because, you know, how long is it going to take them to go from where they are at the moment, off the pace, to being competitive?
The first thing about KTM, everything they've done in motorcycle racing, they've won at. You know, they came in with 125 two strokes. They never won the world title, but they should have done 1 year, but they didn't for various reasons. They were winning races with a 125 two-stroke. They were winning races with a Grand Prix with a 250 two-stroke. They've won the Dakar how many years in a row now? They've ruled at motocross and enduro, and for years and years and years. They came into Moto3, you know, against Honda and started beating Honda straight away, which really didn't please Honda.
Yeah, it's not easy. Yeah, exactly.
And now they're coming in. This is the holy grail, the final frontier. And, you know, they obviously know what they're doing. They're not getting ahead of themselves. They know exactly what they're doing. They've got a very good bunch of engineers, very open-minded. Because they haven't been here before, this level, they're very open-minded. Most of the other companies have been in there for years, so they're very, this is how we do things, da, da, da. So KTM are coming in, they've got very open minds, and I think they'll do really well. I really do think they will. I think this year, almost just don't take, you know, take notice, but it's a testing year. You know, it's their first year in MotoGP. Honda did their first year in MotoGP in 1966. Yamaha in 1972 or 1973, Ducati in, you know, 1970 something. So, you know, it's a, give them a year and then start worrying about lap times in 2018, I would say.
So, but they already seem to be having sort of arguments with Honda, aren't they, KTM? What's going on there? Because they seem quite a feisty bunch.
Yeah, they seem quite keen to pick battles. I think that comes back from, in Moto3, Honda were very unhappy. Kind of Honda saw Moto3 as a kind of production bike championship. You know, you go in and you buy your bike for 30,000 euros or 40,000 euros or whatever, and you go racing. And obviously KTM came in with a factory bike, fair enough. No law against it. But Honda kind of, that kind of rankled them a bit, because obviously KTM with a factory bike beat the Hondas. So I think that was probably the start of it. I don't know whether it goes back further. It might go back to motocross, because obviously they've been together in motocross for many, many years. So I as far as I know, it started in Moto3.
Yeah, and I think, too, that I read something or heard something about an issue with the Paris-Dakar, and there was some things that were going on there. It's interesting because the president or the chairman of the company said, you know, they want to win the world championship and they want to beat Honda. And he stated that at their launch the other day. And you got to have that attitude. You know, if you come into it, well, we're going to do okay, or we, you know, we're just out there. But if you want to really achieve, you have to believe that you can do it, and they've done it. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see the situation they have as the team sits. It'd be obviously be very difficult to win the world championship, but if they continue and willing to make changes, as you said, the key is having an open mind and saying, okay, if this doesn't work, we'll try this. That's going to be the key. You
know? I think also KTM, there's another interesting part of them that they've obviously been having this battle with Honda for many years. How sensible they are to really pick that a vocal public fight with them, I'm not sure. Because when they picked that fight with Moto3, Honda came back. They put their MotoGP engineer onto the Moto3 bikes, and they beat KTM. So, you know, don't make Honda angry.
Yes.
I mean, I remember Kenny Roberts, who was obviously running the Yamaha team back in the early 90s, when the Big Bang came out in 92 and just beat everything. Kenny sort of said, because he used to sort of take the mick out of Honda because their bikes were a bit A-zone, because they used to high side quite a bit. And he was like, I shouldn't have been so rude about them, because now they come out with this bike which is so much better than ours. So there's quite an interesting dynamic there, you know.
We sort of went off onto KTM, but there was something I wanted to ask you about Lorenzo Ducati, Freddie. And is that, I mean, he's, you know, his riding style's super smooth, sort of high, quick, in sort of mid-corner speed, anything like that. But is he going to have to change his style for this Ducati?
Yes.
Is Lorenzo a kind of a style changer like Rossi or, you know, someone like
well,
that?
Well, if you look at, if all we have to go on is history. And from the 250 to the MotoGP bike, he probably, as it turns out, could not have gone to a better bike to suit the way he rode, which is he's really good at anticipating the direction of the bike at mid-corner at the highest speed possible. You watch him when he's on, like going through turn one in Valencia. It's just precision. And it all, you know, that shows a tremendous amount of ability to anticipate the proper point of turn in and carrying the speed. And like I said earlier, I was surprised to hear how little amount of brake pressure he utilizes as he turns the bike in. He can anticipate it, and the bike allowed him to be able to do that. Now we're seeing, he said that he is having to adjust his riding style and change it to use more brake pressure, because the Ducati, if he doesn't do it, it won't finish the corner. And that means having to run too much lean angle, too deep into the corner, and the bike is pointed the wrong direction. Instead of it pointed here, it's here. And the thing is, if it's here, it's still got to turn too much and you can't get on the throttle. And so that's going to be the biggest challenge for him, as well as the unpredictability of the bike from racetrack to racetrack. And so the whole year is going to be adapting. And it, the only way we're going to know is on Sunday afternoons, you know, at the end of the race.
I think you might say that that's the kind of mark of a really truly great rider, is somebody that can adapt.
Sure.
Obviously, Valentino's done it. You know, Jorge, as you said, went from an Aprilia, which was all corner speed, to the M1, which is all, can use all corner speed. And now this is the big test.
Sure.
Can he change to adapt to a different bike? So, like you say, he's under a lot of pressure.
He's under a tremendous amount of pressure.
You know, yeah. From all directions.
Of course.
Is there an element of, you know, obviously Rossi went off to Ducati, it didn't work out. Lorenzo and Rossi have always sort of such great rivals. And, you know, is there anything in Lorenzo's mind saying, you know, I'm never going to be considered better than Rossi if I stay in the same team. I have to go and do.
Well, that's part of what this challenge is for
him. Yeah, at Ducati, what he didn't.
He wants to do something Valentino couldn't, because he's not going to win, you know, that many. Yeah, and so that's part of it, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, which is just another pressure.
Yeah, which you know, is exactly. Another, you know. Well, that's even a more personal one.
Yeah.
For him.
Which can be the worst.
Exactly,
because,
of course.
Because they're the ones that really get you here, aren't they?
Well, they're
heart.
The ones when no one else is around that you feel. Absolutely, yeah.
I'm glad I'm not Lorenzo on the MotoGP grid this year. Suzuki, a lot more pressure on him than normal. But Suzuki, we haven't talked about them yet. They were quite fast at the test, weren't they, Matt?
I think what they've done, I don't think it's really been shouted about enough, really, because, you know, they were out of MotoGP for 5 years. And when they were in MotoGP, you know, they weren't throwing as nearly as much effort into it as the other factories, and it showed. Then they were out for 5 years, and they came back straight away, and the bike was like, wow, you know, this is a really good motorcycle. And I think it might have the best chassis out there. It's just so, I mean, you just look at it, and it looks almost like a 250. It looks so tiny, and they say that they chose Iannone specifically for his style. He's got a very, very attacking kind of style. And I think last year, the only guy that crashed less on the Michelins than he had on the Bridgestones was Vinales, which is probably something about the rider. All the other riders crashed twice as much on the Michelins as they had on Bridgestones. Vinales crashed half as much. He's the only guy. So that might be partly down to him. But I think it's also partly down to the bike. It's very nice going into corners. And I think Iannone is very attacking going into corners. So I think it could really work. And the thing is pretty much on a par with speed with the Yamaha now, you know. And so it would be great to see them, because they're such a tiny little company compared to Yamaha and Honda. And Ducati in the size of their race department, tiny. It would be great to see them in there as well, you know.
It's what's interesting about the characteristics of the bike is it kind of holds to form what I was saying earlier. One of the things about the GSXR 1000 for years has been its rideability, the chassis, the forgiveness of the bike. And that, as you said, that bike with Iannone, who is an attacker, the bike, it's one of those situations where it could be a perfect fit.
Yeah, he needs a lot of forgiveness.
Exactly, exactly. You know, he does, or he could, exactly. And so I think it'd be interesting to see if they have stepped up, because we know that Honda has, and we know that Yamaha, as we were talking about, and so it'd be interesting to see where Suzuki, as the season goes on, how it plays out.
You do sometimes see that with factories that, you know, they kind of seem to catch up a bit, and you think, hey, they really caught up next last year, and this year will be the time where they do catch up, but no, because everybody else has gone like
exactly.
that. So, you know, there's sometimes factories with smaller resources and so on, you know, they're improving at the same rate as the factories with the bigger resources, but you need to do more than that to actually get on a level, you know.
You know, with all these factories in MotoGP and, you know, the sort of roll call of the names, the riders at the moment, Freddie, I mean, is it fair to say that we are experiencing a golden age? I think it's always easy to look back and say, oh, the, you know, the 1990s, what a great era that was, or whatever it is. But actually, it's quite sometimes quite difficult to admit that right now is one of the sort of sport's great eras. Would you agree with that?
I think it's certainly a great era. And you have, you know, is it last year it showed how many different riders won races? Obviously, you still have the top two or three guys that week in and week out are always there. And it's great when you have, as we're seeing this year, to me what's exciting is Vinales and Mark and where they can push themselves to get to that next level of performance. And then who can stay up there with them? You know, who's going to be willing or who can do it week, again, even if it's one race, but for sure week in and week out. So I think it's a great time with the manufacturers involved, with KTM getting involved, Aprilia, you know, we really hadn't mentioned them, but Aprilia getting involved, you know, to push along. But still, it's Yamaha and Honda and now Ducati, but it's still going to be about them. And I'm one of those that I just want to see great racing, you know. I like to see guys push themselves. I'm looking for the uniqueness. You know, part of that is because I'm as inside as they come. You know, I call it inside the fence and outside. But I, as far as what I notice and what I pick up on everybody, and you respect, because I know how difficult that is, you know, to do that and or to do something that no one else has done. And, you know, we're in that era right now, you know, that we could see that.
Because I've just been shown a sign saying that you're on stage in 10 minutes, so shouldn't hold you up for any longer. But what an incredible season that we've got to look forward to, and exciting stuff. But looking at the sort of the motorsport MotoGP A team here, because we've obviously got usual content from you, Matt, throughout the year, and Freddie, you're going to be contributing as well through video, audio, and all that stuff, which is
be great.
Really
look
exciting.
Forward to it. Yeah.
So thank you so much for all the
insight.
Well, no,
I enjoy it's being here with you guys. It really is great.
That's
I appreciate that.
Very kind, but Matt, thank you so much, and thank you to Alan behind the camera, and thank you to all the listeners and the viewers as well. We're going to be back very soon for another motorsport podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz. Thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.